Welcome to Pacific Beer Chat. I'm Mike, and
My name's Brent.
And you are?
We am the CEO and founding partner at Backroads Brewing Company.
Perfect. And that is in Nelson.
We are in Nelson, BC. Exactly.
All right. So are you from Nelson originally then?
Funny enough, I am from Nelson originally. But I moved away when I was like 4 years old or 5 years old. And I grew up in Richmond.
Okay.
And then I moved back to Nelson in 2010. So I'm coming up on about 9 or 10 years now. Nice. Full-time living here. Yeah.
I guess, what's your background in beer then? Did you start out as a home brewer?
Zero. I had no background in beer other than drinking it. I'd always been really interested in owning a pub. And my whole background is in the ski industry. And the idea for starting a brewery came about in sort of the mid-2000s. I was living in Switzerland and had some opportunities to go to small little breweries in Austria and southern Germany and a little bit in Switzerland, and that kind of just sparked it. But I was like, oh, how am I going to do this? I'm not a brewer and I'm not a business guy or anything. And then that idea just never really went away. And eventually, after I decided it was time to leave the ski industry, I just couldn't shake the business idea of starting a brewery. And so I went back to business school and I started at Royal Roads and wrote a business plan for a brewery and did all the research and decided to go in kind of head first.
Nice.
So it worked.
It's good to hear, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to jump head first, you want it to go well.
Yeah. But we lucked out. I've got a couple of business partners. My other business partner, Tracy, who was sort of the first, she joined on board with me kind of right away when I sort of put it out there in the world that I was looking for business partners. And she also doesn't have a background in breweries. But then very, very luckily, we secured Mike Kelly, who was brewing at NBC. And he's been in the brewing industry for 25, 27 years.
Just a couple.
So we got a hold of someone who kind of knew the beer end of things, because that was the missing piece of the puzzle for a while we were developing the business. Yeah.
That is a very big, important part.
It's a big, important part. Yeah. And a few people thought we were a little bit crazy when we were kind of pushing forward with this plan and we didn't have a brewer. But at the same time, we had been doing our research and we had been conducting interviews. And funny enough, the week that that Mike walked in to sort of formalize our discussions, I was about to fly out three brewers that we'd interviewed. I think two from Ontario and another guy from Northern BC.
Jeez.
So we were ready to pull the trigger on somebody else. And it was all guys that were working at bigger breweries in southern Ontario that were looking for the opportunity to have a small town lifestyle in Western Canada. And I had to call them back and be like, I'm really sorry, guys, but we're no longer flying you out to BC. We found a local brewer who's very, very experienced, and he also wants to buy a piece of the company. So
that helps.
It worked perfectly. So we were very happy with that.
And those plane tickets aren't cheap.
Plane tickets are not cheap, let alone many, many other things. The risk associated with bringing in someone unknown to us who you have three or four interviews versus with Mike. Mike's been here for a long time. I've been in town for, as I said, a long time. Mike's kids were on ski teams that I managed at the ski areas. So I already knew Mike pretty well. Through living in a small town and being in the same kind of outdoor ski circles.
Yeah, for sure.
With everybody else. So it's perfect.
Well, I've watched a lot of Ontario brewers move to BC into the city and start up brewing there and become head brewers and decide to go home. So, I mean,
they
could have worked here for a couple of years and then just buggered off again, right?
You never know, especially when you're, pulling in from someone out east who has this romantic idea of what it's like to live in the mountains of the West, and then they realize it's a little bit different than living in downtown Toronto.
Yeah, it gets just as much snow probably, but doesn't go.
It's not as cold. It's not as cold as there, but you're forever a day away from anything. There's no like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna whip out to wherever, like down to the city for the day. And you're like, well, for us in the middle of winter, it's a 10-hour drive to Vancouver, and
it's still a 7-ish hour, 8-hour drive in the summer, regardless.
And the highway may or may not be open on the week you want to go, and there's all kinds of challenges to living rurally in the mountains of BC. But if you love it, you love it.
Yeah, so. No, I love coming out and you're visiting for sure. It's a long drive.
Yeah.
So when did you guys actually open? It's been a couple years now.
Yeah, we opened March 23rd, 2017. So we're kind of two and a bit years, approaching 2.5 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how are things going? I mean,
fantastically. Yeah, it's been a really, really good couple of years. We, in our, after, just after 1 year of business, we had to undertake a huge, like a, for us, a huge expansion. We had to double our brewing capacity. So we added 10 more brewing tanks into the building. We added the packaging room that's in behind us here. So that was a sort of a bit of storage space and like office space for us. So that got converted into production space and packaging space. And then now that we've got, so that was a big undertaking because we kind of had to do some renovations to the building on top of that, which we couldn't afford to do when we first were opening. Yeah. So we really had to like, originally we would have done all this at once, but because myself nor Mike nor Tracy come from money, we just and we didn't want to take on more outside business help or business investors, we just couldn't afford to kind of do the whole thing all at once. So we kind of did half of it, essentially added the other half after 1 year, which was great. We thought it might take us 2 years to be at the point to add that space. So that's done well, and now we've just because of that we've been able to expand our sales region. So we're now distributing beer all throughout the Okanagan. And we just signed on a couple accounts in the East Kootenai, so then that's going to start going to Kimberley, Cranbrook, Fernie area over over the next few months here.
That's awesome.
So it's great that we're kind of, you know, getting out there and growing our footprint, and we're definitely making beer on a you know, on a hectoliter basis, on a yearly basis. We're definitely kind of just a little bit ahead of what we thought we would be at, and we have a good amount of runway to be able to grow into the size of business that we wanted to be after 5 years. So it's going really well.
Nice. Well, I guess what was your actual production size when you started then? Do you know?
The brewery was capable of doing maybe about 1,000 hectoliters.
Okay.
1,100, somewhere in that range. That's kind of what Mike had sort of guesstimated based on the configuration and how we were using things.
Yeah.
And I think in that first year we did 800. So we were kind of like, uh-oh.
Close.
We're
going to... Very close.
And in the summertime, we were not able to keep up.
Yeah.
So that was a big problem. So that's that first summer of business, or the first full summer, we struggled to keep 8 beers on... We have 8 taps. We struggled to keep 8 beers on the board. And then by the next winter, that was constantly the same thing. It was consistently running out. And we're sort of in a unique position here. Our winter business rivals our summer business because of the ski hills and all the ski touring and stuff like that going around. So we, when a lot of breweries see a sales slump in February and March, we get a massive bump from all the tourism coming through. So all of a sudden we're having twice a year, we're having shortage issues on the board, and we're like, uh-oh, this is going to be problematic.
And I'm sure it's very similar to Whistler and stuff for the breweries there.
Yeah, the breweries in Whistler would have the same thing. And I know I've talked to the guys and girls up at Begbie Brewing and out in Fernie.
Yep.
And same things. All the BC ski towns get a really, really healthy bump
I believe
in sales.
It, yeah.
And I'm sure the Vancouver brewers would love to see that business come through.
I guess for the Vancouver people, they already have just a lot more people, so there's an easier group to pull from. But
yeah, there's probably not the same...
Slump's probably not as big.
Yeah, the peaks and valleys aren't as probably as robust as they are around here. But it's nice that we get a bump from the winter tourism.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I don't know. Winter tourism here, just unless I flew, I don't want to drive that drive.
Yeah, you know, once you get a good pair of snow tires on your car, it's not so bad.
It's not me on the road that I worry about.
It's the other people.
I drive for a living. I'm scared of everyone on the road.
If we had an airport that would like be reliable in the wintertime, this would be a big difference.
Yeah. It's a pretty small airport.
It's a small airport, but I think it has like a 60% success rate of landings in the wintertime. It's pretty bad.
Geez, that's
Cancelgar, it's affectionately referred to as.
And it looks like there must be a really tiny one here too in Rob's or in Nelson.
Yeah, so there is an airport in town here. There's no commercial flights into that, so it's mostly just private jets.
Rich people
that come in. Rich people going heli skiing, cat skiing generally is what comes in on that one, and a few private pilots. And
then I guess that they probably have a really good landing rate there. Then When you got rich people?
Yeah, they probably do, actually. I have no idea. I mean, you see the planes come in every now and again. Every day on like a Saturday when it's transfer day for the heli-ski operations, you see the planes coming in. You're like, all right, well, these guys are making it.
I've definitely seen some small props go down the last couple days here.
Yeah, definitely.
So what I guess we talked about what you started out with. What is your current capacity then?
The way we're set up now, I think Mike had told us that we could probably churn out about 2,800 hectoliters a year, maybe as much as 3,000.
That's a big jump.
If we're doing things as efficiently as he wants to be doing it.
Yeah.
So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We have 6 fermenters and 16 bright tanks.
Nice.
8 of the bright tanks are connected up to the tap, so we're actually using as serving tanks. Now we have, and then the bright tanks that are in the packaging now are actually functioning more as true bright tanks.
Okay.
So we're turning them over a lot faster. It's just sort of a matter of whether or not we can get the beer back out and into store shelves as fast as we want it to.
Yeah, for sure. What's the size of your brew house?
We are 8 hectoliters.
Okay, nice and small.
7 barrels. Yeah, that was the biggest possible size we could get into this building. So, you've been here before.
Yes, one time.
We are a very, very small brew house back in there. It's a very efficient use of space, we have to say. But for those of you that haven't been here before, we are not in an industrial area. We are in the middle of downtown Nelson. We are in a 70-year-old commercial building that was never meant to have a brewery in it.
Of course not. Yeah.
And so it's so we had to do some things to shoehorn in the equipment. We definitely are very labor intensive, more so than most other breweries are. A lot of our materials are, you know, unloaded in the back alley and then we hand bomb them down into our storage areas. It's way more than it needs to be.
Yeah.
But we did everything because we wanted the customer to be able to walk down the street and be like, oh, look, there's a brewery, and pop in.
Yeah.
Like, and our foot traffic on our main street is thousands and thousands of people a day. And so that translates to a really, really hopping tap room. And that's...
Yeah. It doesn't hurt that your tap room is a nice size. You've got the patio out front.
Yeah, exactly. When we undertook our expansion for our brewing equipment, we also expanded the tap room seating capacity. So we converted a janitor closet into a bathroom and that doubled our capacity. So now we're 100 people inside and we're 20 on the patio.
That poor janitor though.
Yeah. Which is me.
Yeah, I know exactly.
So that worked out really well, you know, cause now 100 people in here, which is a nice healthy size.
Yeah, it definitely is.
So before when it was 55, we would consistently have lineups to get in on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, and that was getting really, really frustrating.
Well, at least back then you probably didn't have much more beer for the people anyways.
No, no, we didn't. The problem was we also couldn't send them anywhere else because we didn't have enough beer to sell to a lot of the pubs around us.
Yeah.
So I think we had beer in like maybe one or two restaurants. So, you know, when we had a lineup, you could say, hey, go to, you know, X place down the road. At least you can get a pint. Whereas now we can get them all in and we can supply, I think we have... I don't know, 15 or so restaurants and pubs around town.
Wow, that's awesome.
That have our beer on tap as well that, you know, originally had been asking us, how do we get your beer? And we're like, well, sorry, we just don't have enough. And now we can sort of afford to have beer out there in various locations around town. And
it's always good to see a small town really, like, rallying around the local business, right? And which usually happens.
Yeah.
But it's nice to see.
It usually happens, and we're lucky here in Nelson because we've had Nelson Brewing Company here since 1991 or 92, the idea of drinking local beer is not a foreign concept to people here. And, I mean, Nelsonites and Kootenai people are fiercely loyal to local business as it stands anyways. You know, we're very anti-chain. And like you see that walking around town. There's no... McDonald's on the main street. There's no Starbucks on the main street. There's all these things that are, it's all independent small mom and pop businesses. And so all these local restaurants are all really, really wanting to have the local beer on tap.
Yeah,
and NBC was able to break down those barriers in the 90s.
Yeah.
And so when it comes time to buying local beer, you talk to a business person around here and they're like, yeah, sure. Like, we'll definitely take the local products because they know it's important to do that.
No, so for sure, yeah.
It's great.
It's good for business.
But I can imagine in smaller towns where they're getting their first brewery, it's an uphill battle to convince people to take your product on.
Oh, God, yeah.
So.
Well, I'm always a nerd for like beer names of breweries or beer names.
Yeah.
Where did you come up with the name for Backroads?
So Backroads was a one of a list of about 50 names that I had going on. And I had all kinds of crazy things. Some of them were, like, you know, Nelson-centric, and they would have been very localized, and some of them were really random and completely abstract. And so I kind of paired that. I sat around with a few friends of mine, and we paired that list down to, about 15 or so choices. And then I put it out in a SurveyMonkey to my Facebook friends.
Yeah.
I have about 400 friends or something like that that sort of responded back. And I told them, pick as many options as you like.
Yeah.
And Backroads came back with like 60% of the votes.
That's awesome.
I was quite surprised. Anecdotally, and this is a really funny story that I think is funny. My favorite choice was totally, like, was the least voted for. But also Backcountry Brewing at the time, which we had been researching, was also voted down. So there you go. We get confused with them all the time.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
Yeah, and when I was researching the names back in early 2015, it was one that still wasn't taken yet.
That's amazing.
And it was not a choice either.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. Yeah, you guys opened up fairly close together.
I think within the same week, roughly.
Long distance away from each other.
It's a long distance away, but, you know, we're a cabin-themed brewery, they're a cabin-themed brewery.
Yeah.
There's a lot of similarities that when we first opened and saw them opening, we're like, holy smokes, like, we were like on the same wavelength.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, we're both from similar types of towns and similar types of backgrounds. And
yeah. I spent a lot of time in Squamish hiking and stuff, and I spent a lot of time tasting room.
Yeah, so it makes sense, right? They sort of have these similar ideas. But it was just really funny that that wasn't our name. And we got Backroads instead, and we like it.
It's a good thing people voted that one down, right?
Yeah.
I guess every brewery has to have a kind of a hook. What's kind of your hook for your beers? What do you use to kind of bring people in?
So we definitely started out by really leaning on Mike's experience as a brewer.
Yeah,
that was the starting point when we first were sort of, you know, announcing to the world that we were opening, and we were able to say, "Hey, Mike Kelly is the brewmaster," and we were able to lean on those 20. At the time, I think it was 22 years or 23 years of brewing experience and 10 or 11 as the brewmaster at NBC. So people were super familiar with the beers that he made and with sort of the quality and the consistency that he put out. And so we definitely said that. It was like, this is a real central tenet of us, that we have a super, super experienced brewer. And so when you're going to come into our facility and try our beers for the first time, you know that you're getting beers from someone who's been making beer for a very long time and has made a lot of your favorite beers at other brewery, whether as here or at House Sound or at Whistler Brewing Company. Or,
you know,
he's made a lot of beers that are favorites of people.
Yeah, for sure.
And that was definitely the start. And then as we sort of evolved now, we've made a lot of lagers. Mike really likes his lagers. And so we definitely try to lean on the fact that we're doing a lot of lager styles that, you know, a lot of craft breweries don't,
or they're just starting to,
and we've got, you know, someone here who's been making lagers for a long time, making very good ones.
Yeah,
and so that's been a thing. And then it's funny, I have to push Mike really hard to make trendy styles of beers, and that'll never be our hook. We'll never be a brewery that, you know, tries to make the haziest and the juiciest of beers, but we will throw, you know, a hazier or juicy beer out there every now and again, only after we sort of ask Mike for about 6 months to make one, and then he'll he'll find. It's funny, we've got a Goza on the board right now. It was the first time he's ever made a Goza.
Really?
Funny enough, yeah, I remember he was commenting on that when he was cracking open the bag of acidulated malt. He's like, I've never used this malt before in 20 some odd years. And he's like, really? He's like, yeah, there's never a desire to.
Well, it's time to learn.
It's time to learn. And and so that we've had that the Goza on tap now for I think a week, and it's quickly becoming a favorite of many, many people.
That's but awesome.
I don't know if it's just the trend with the sour styles right now, or if it's a combination of if it's a really good beer and the trends. And
well, they're also usually like extremely drinkable.
Yes,
especially on a hot day on a patio.
Hot day on the patio after, yeah, especially, you know, day after mountain biking or hiking, and you've worked up a big sweat, and having a salty beer, it goes over so well.
You need those electrolytes.
Exactly. Exactly.
What is your core lineup of beer then? I mean, every brewery seems to have a core.
Yeah, so we put up four styles year-round. We do a Saison, just a very basic Saison, which is very good.
Yeah.
We do a Golden Ale, Eldorado Golden Ale, which uses Eldorado hops primarily in the dry hopping. So that's what we would call our light beer whenever someone comes in and asks for what's the lightest.
Yeah.
We steer them at the Golden Ale. We do a West Coast style pale ale. And then we have our First Descent Northwest IPA, so a Northwest style IPA.
Yeah. Nice and bitter.
Nice and bitter and clear and kind of dank and earthy. And the pale ale is nice big kind of tropical fruit and kind of flavors and aromas. Not a lot of bitterness. That pale ale specifically, when we were kind of getting in the final stages of getting the brewery setup done, we were drinking a lot of Strange Fellows Talisman and a little bit of Persephone pale ale at the same time. And Mike would drink both those styles, hoppy, not bitter, and low in alcohol. And he's just like, I really love these beers. I want to make, a hoppy, low alcohol pale style. Yeah. And so that's how that one came about.
And you're pulling from some pretty good breweries there too.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah. I know Mike's good friends with Ian over at Strange Fellows, so definitely respects a lot of the, what he puts out there.
Yeah. And I used to live fairly close to Strange Fellows. I used to spend a lot of time there. Kind of miss it, actually.
Yeah. So those are our core styles, and then we have a big rotating list of limited batch releases. So this year we switched to doing a new limited batch release every single month.
That's awesome.
Which is great. I mean, it's nice. We have, enough tank space now that we have the flexibility to be able to put out a lot of different styles. And
even when brewing lagers that are a lot slower.
All those tanks, Mike was allowed to have a dedicated lagering tank.
There we go.
And maybe even two dedicated lagering tanks, which is great. So he can manage that. And at the same time, we can churn out a lot of different things. And so now we're starting to have the room to be able to put out things like a juicy IPA last month. We had a craft beer week. And we have a Hefeweizen this month. And next month is a dry hopped white ale. And that's where we're starting to get a little bit more, not experimental. I won't say that. It's not the right word. But Mike's pushing his
boundaries.
A little bit. Yeah. Yeah. Frankly, he's doing some stuff that's maybe outside of his comfort zone or outside of his wheelhouse. But we're also able to sort of very nimbly react to trends and make sure we put out some beers and bottles in a timely fashion that people might pick up, and in the hopes that they'll sort of, get some awareness of our brand, and then eventually maybe they'll, also shift towards some of our core styles that they can rely on to be there all of the time.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. But I mean, it's always good to have something that changes up all the time to bring people in, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the biggest thing. That's what we find that there's definitely not a lot of loyalty anymore in beer to one specific brand or one specific beer specifically. But if we can get someone turned onto our brand in general and get them hooked on a whatever style of beer, and that way at least when they walk in, they see a Backroads product on a shelf, in Kelowna or Vernon or something like that, and they can sort of say, hey, I had a really good one from them that time, and now I can try something else. And
gone are the days where people just go in for their favorite 24 case of the same beer every time.
Yeah, exactly. At least on the liquor store side of it.
Yeah.
There they move around. Whereas here in the pub, we have people that will drink the same beer all of the time.
Really?
Yeah, it's quite surprising the difference in their buying habits when they pick up a beer on a liquor store shelf versus when they come in here and and they drink Golden Ale till the cows come home, where they have one kind of hoppy beer and then it's to, the easier drinking style because they know they can have, four or five of them in a sitting.
Yeah, I can understand that part, yeah. Although I know when I go to a brewery, it's almost never the same beer. It's like, what's new?
Yeah.
And if it's a brewery I haven't been to in a long time or a new brewery, it's always flight first.
Yeah, absolutely. And we get a lot of that, And you get your locals that are always looking for the new stuff and they like to switch it up. And we keep things rotating pretty good with eight taps. There's four constants and four rotators, and kind of gives just enough newness. So when you come in every, even if it's only once a month that you come in because you live somewhere out of town and you don't get in here regularly, at least you're going to see something new. And then, your favorite standby is still going to be there.
Yeah. I mean, if you live fairly close, you should come more than once a month.
Oh, yeah. There's many folks that come way more than that.
I mean, I've got 700 kilometers between me and the brewery. Yeah. I don't know. A little more excuse for the 2 years.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough.
All right. Well, you got a flight in front of me here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the beers here. Number seven.
Lemon Drop Lager. Brand new today.
Even better. So can you tell me a little bit about this lager then?
Lemon Drop hops are the hop in that one, which is where the name comes from. A little bit of lemon zest. And other than that, a fairly basic kind of malt profile for an easy drinking lager. They're kind of, you know, pretty light in color and fairly clear.
Yeah, it's fairly clear, yeah.
I think Mike would
definitely
love...
Definitely
unfiltered, yeah. Mike, he's probably fined it twice, and he would probably want it to sit for another couple of weeks. Well, there's always an on-running joke that Mike's got these beers, and he'll tell us about them, and he'll get really excited. And then he won't release them. And we'll keep asking him, when's it coming out? And he's like, another week. And
when it's ready.
When it's ready, which is great.
Yeah.
You know, his bar for quality is like through the roof. It's up here. Sometimes we think he's got a private reserve in the back and there's beers that he will never, ever release. But he secretly is just drinking them after work.
Oh, probably.
And we never know. There's 16 tanks for us to look at.
Yeah. Now, this definitely has that, like, just the lemon drop hop aroma. It's like big lemon. It's kind of sweet. A little bit grainy, maybe. Pretty basic nose, but mm-hmm. in a good way.
Yeah.
Definitely a lot more grain in the flavor.
Yeah.
Lots of lemon. Not really, no real bitterness, but you get kind of that herbalness from a hop.
Yeah, I find
it's not quite resin either. It's more pithy.
Yeah, you get the zest. Yeah, kind of the zest bitterness. Yeah.
That's nice. So like I'm not the biggest Yellow Fizzy Lager fan, but this is got enough flavor that it kind of reminds me of like a lighter pale ale or something.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Yeah, we think that one will be a bit of a patio crusher. Just enough kind of citrusy kind of bitterness in it that when you're on a super hot day, it's just going to quench the taste buds.
I could definitely drink a couple of these. Yeah, that's super drinkable. Lagers are definitely not an easy style to make. And there's nothing wrong with that at all.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, so the next one is Go Big or Go Hef.
Go Big or Go Hef, Hefeweizen. So Bavarian style. Not really anything overly complicated in that one. Bavarian Hefeweizen yeast. And a pretty simple malt and hop profile, so really letting the yeast shine in this one.
A little hazier than the last one.
When did they have the last one out?
No, the last lager. The lager.
It's a little hazier than the lager.
I've definitely seen hazier.
Yeah, that one's, how old is it now? A couple weeks we've had that one on tap, so it's probably starting to drop a little bit clear as it sits in the big serving tanks.
It's got kind of that banana and a little bit of citrusy notes.
Yeah.
Little wheat. It's got a really nice nose. It's one of those styles that I don't run out of my way to have. And then I have them like, it's really tasty.
Yeah.
And then I order an IPA. it's really tasty. It's almost a little more citrusy than banana, I find, this one. It's really nice. It's definitely the wheat and grain. Mm-hmm. Got a lot going on.
Yeah, that one is a good example of, you know, Mike's approach towards brewing and that, you know, We will often make beers that are very, very traditional. So Mike loves traditional anything. But he also wants to go back to styles that are sort of tried and true and proven. And, you know, if you were to walk into a craft brewery 10 years ago, like in the summertime, a Hefeweizen was a guaranteed beer to be on the board.
Yeah, oh, definitely it was.
And you just don't see it very often anymore. It's sort of fallen by the wayside as people keep going for the uber hoppy styles. But we still like keeping a couple things on the board that people will sort of know.
Yeah.
And Hefeweizen's that one, especially for the 35 and the 40-year-old and up crowd who might not be a huge craft beer connoisseur. They'll walk in and see Hefeweizen and go, oh, yeah, I know that. I know what that's going to be, and I'll drink that style. And so we can get them in through that gateway.
Yeah. Well, there's still a lot of people, when they hear craft beer, they just think West Coast IPA.
Yeah.
And there's so many other flavors. Now, I still love a West Coast IPA.
Yeah.
I think I drink more of the New England style IPAs now, the juicy ones. But it doesn't all have to be bitter. Like, there's so many different flavors. And there's room for a half on every board, I think. It's
exactly.
Just, people just chase the trend too often sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes that's kind of the case. And, you know, with eight beers on tap, you can't I mean, you could have 8 super hoppy beers if you wanted to.
Twin sales.
Yeah. But I think that's, you're alienating people.
At the same time, I think it works better if, like with Twin Sales in Port Moody, there's 4 breweries in like 3 blocks.
Yeah.
So when you've got so many breweries in such a small area, it's easier to specialize in one thing, because if they don't like it, they just go to the next one.
That's
right?
True. Yeah.
And if you don't have the right beers there, you say, go to these guys because they got the beers you want, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're not quite there in Nelson yet where we have enough people to support a highly, highly niched brewery yet. You could get it there.
Because there's the beer farmers in Pemberton, which is, they're a potato farm for like 3 or 4 generations that opened up a brewery. The mom decided she wanted to open a brewery.
Yeah.
And they're doing like crazy farmhouse styles.
Yeah. Mike is good friends with them, actually.
Okay, there you go.
He used to live in Pemberton, so he's very, very good friends with them.
Yeah, really good beer.
Yeah.
And they're pretty darn highly specialized, considering they're in the middle of friggin' nowhere.
That's true. This is true. But I think, you know, when you're on the doorstep of how many million tourists show up to Whistler every year, you've got...
It's about an hour past, but still, yeah.
But that's in their zone, whereas, you know, for us around here, it's like when you leave Nelson and drive for an hour, you have, like, hardworking resource towns, Castlegar and Trail or Cranbrook, and we don't have the same level of beer knowledge in this part of the Kootenays yet, even though Nelson has some beer knowledge because of NBC being around for so long. You know, and Fernie's got some beer knowledge from Fernie Brewing Company, and same thing with Revy. But, like, Fernie and Revy and Nelson are very kind of progressive and hippie towns.
Yes.
Compared to, Fernie's even, you know, still a coal mining town realistically, but, you know, they've got a lot more city folks that live in these towns, whereas you go to Trail and Castlegar and they're still super, super blue collar.
Oh, hell yeah.
And
they like
their domestic lager. And it can be, you know, really, really hard to get them to switch over to funkier styles. So, but it'll come. It's getting there. There's enough of us opening up now around here that we're slowly kind of getting people aware and turning them on to the weird and wonderful.
Well, you have to just look at every place that craft beer is new. Like even Alberta a couple of years ago, right? Mm-hmm. What's happening now in Alberta is amazing. It's exploded. And I like the fact that with Alberta's explosion, it's not like in BC where it was like Metro Vancouver and Victoria that were the first explosions. It seems like it's the smaller towns that are exploding in Alberta more.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
I think it's great.
I mean, like Edmonton and Calgary are exploding too.
They're going to have them, yeah.
But it seems like there's more small towns opening up breweries than there are in BC.
Yeah, it took rural BC a lot longer to get on the train. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, some of it is probably has to do with municipal politics and zoning bylaws. And, you know, when we approached the city of Nelson to put our brewery in, I found out that our zoning bylaws already allowed for breweries downtown, but then, like, it was really funny. They changed the bylaws in 2010 to allow breweries in commercial core zones, but none of the people in the bylaw office even knew that that was allowed. And so we had to
That's bizarre.
Sit down and chat with them. And then I know they're asking us all these questions. And every time I would talk to them about, hey, we're opening the brewery and here's what we're doing. And they kept mentioning restaurants. And we were like, guys, I'm not opening a restaurant. I'm opening a brewery. Like, why is this so hard for you? They just didn't get it. They didn't understand the model. And it's like there are a lot of, and I've heard anecdotally from other kind of people I've chatted to now that we've opened. And of course, as when you open a brewery, everyone else who wants to open a brewery will always be reaching out to you to ask you about how this worked. And I've heard some pretty big horror stories from bigger towns, you know, places like Vernon, for example, where they just can't work with the local politicians to even allow these things to open up, you know, in the right locations, and they're struggling. And so I think that was the case in a lot of small towns in BC, where it's just the towns weren't ready to have breweries. And then when someone came in and said, hey, let's do this.
Yeah.
And the local towns just made it really, really difficult to put them in. Whereas Vancouver and Victoria kind of made it easy relatively.
In certain zones.
Yeah. I mean, it still flabbergasts me when you hear about places like North Vancouver that had ridiculous no patio rules, or
City of Vancouver.
Yeah,
like, unless you're a brew pub, you can't have a patio.
Yeah, like it's just some of that stuff. I just shake my head. You know, like, what's going on? Like, how is this still a thing?
But
so I think that's why you didn't see it. Whereas in Alberta, they saw the trend, and I think a lot of places were able to get on board with it because they had seen so much happening in BC in general, and all the towns were able to jump on board. And
I don't think it hurt either that they were a fairly depressed economy, so any way you can bring in money and work, go for it, right? And there's I was talking to Paul Hadfield from Spinnaker's just the other day, and craft beer is very inefficient in a good way.
Yeah.
Because it causes a lot of jobs.
Yeah, exactly. And all those oil guys that need to park their money somewhere.
Yeah.
Park it in breweries. And
they can't afford to work at a brewery because they don't make enough, but yeah, they can definitely park their money.
They can park their money in there, and then, you know, all the grain farmers are probably ecstatic to be able to start selling their grain to to malting houses locally, and you know, it works. It's a really easy sell when you can be in, you know, some small card store, Alberta or something like that, and be like, oh yeah, the grain comes from just down the road.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's an easy sell for a lot of people, I think.
No, exactly.
We've got the Jim Nickers Fruity Goza.
Jim Nickers. What's the story behind that name?
Okay, so we've got a couple of British staff members that work here, and one day we were talking about gym class. I don't know how we got onto this conversation, but we were talking about gym class in the UK and the fact that in most schools still, if you're a female in a gym class in London, you have to wear a skirt when you go to gym class. And so because of that, you now have to wear a special pair of like shorts underneath your skirt when you're playing sports.
Yeah.
And those are called gym knickers.
Oh God.
And then Mike overheard the conversation and he's like, that's the name of a beer. And the Goza just happened to be the next beer coming out on tap.
Nice.
Kind of a couple of days later that didn't have a name yet.
Yeah.
And so it got, but Jim wanted, or sorry, Jim, Mike wanted to change it so that it was Jim, like the name of a guy as opposed to Jim, like a gymnasium. So that's kind of where, you know, it's Jim Nickers is Fruity Goza. But
that's awesome.
Yeah.
This one is quite murky. It looks similar to like the New England style IPAs, actually.
Yeah, pretty murky for sure. We aged it on lemon and lime wedges.
Damn.
That we had a lot of lemon and lime wedges left over from the lemon drop lager because we had zested a bunch of limes, lemons for that, and then we had some limes a while ago. We made some kind of a lime zested beer maybe back in March, and so we had zested all these boxes of lemons and limes.
Yeah,
and then we didn't know what to do with the actual limes and lemons, so we had in our freezer we had like 3 like 80 liter totes just of the whole fruit sitting in there, and like, we need to do something with this. And Mike was making the Goza, and he just made it like a straight kind of Goza with no sort of additions to it.
Yeah.
And wasn't super happy. He thought it was a bit bland.
Okay.
And so he's like, oh, why don't I just, you know, chunk up this fruit, throw it into a bag and chuck it in the fermenter, and we'll let it sit around for a while and flavor the beer a little bit. So we ended up with, it's called a Fruity Goza on the board.
Yeah.
To me, I think we should actually call it a Lemon Lime Goza.
Yeah.
Or a Margarita Goza, something is the popular style right now that's out there.
Yeah, I mean.
But it has
get a pint of this and drop in a shot of tequila.
Yeah, you could if you really wanted to. But it definitely has a sort of lemon-lime kind of flavor front, and then a bit of the saltiness.
I haven't even tasted it yet, but yeah, if you put a salt rim on there, it'd be a margarita, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You don't need the salt rim. That's got lots of salinity to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit tart, lots of lime, a little bit of lemon,
yeah,
bit of pith in there. That's really nice.
Yeah, that one's
another patio crusher.
That's a patio crusher. We've had that one on tap for about a week now. And already people are just like, is there going to be more of this? Like, they're already fearing the day the tank runs out. And so that's definitely going to stay around for a little while. I think we were just talking about this morning, actually, in our production meeting. That'll definitely get made again, so it stays on through kind of the heat of the summer.
Yeah, I was talking to the guys at Torchlight, and they've got similar issues with some of their beers that they thought would just be like a one-off or something, and then it's like, nope, got to make it again. Ah, shit, again.
Yeah,
again.
Exactly.
Damn it.
Which is great. That's what you want.
Yeah, as long as you got tank space for it, right?
As long as you got the space for it. But if your goal is to keep rotating beers all the time, you know, because you want to make a lot of different styles, and like, I know Mike's got this, like, he's got a huge list of styles he wants to make. And when we first, you know, in the first couple of years, we made a lot of different beers. Like, I think on our untapped list, I think we're up to 49 beers now that we put out there. But it's definitely slowed down in the new style category because people keep demanding styles return.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people are thirsty.
Yeah, they're thirsty. And it's funny that they remember, we put out like an Irish Red Ale when we first opened.
Yeah.
That you would have had, actually.
Yep,
and
I did. Yep.
And we get requests for that beer all the time. people were like, when's the Irish Red coming back? And it's like, yes, that was 2 years ago. And then they made it 1 year ago again. And now you wanted to, like, so it's nice that people sort of remember those things and they want them to come back.
Yeah.
But other ones like this Goza, there's people are already telling us, they're like, don't let it run out.
So maybe you just need like a tiny pilot badge system that you can just throw up a keg.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have a pilot batch system. Every time we make a batch of beer, we make the full 800 liters of it. Yeah. We sort of think that a pilot system is probably a bit unnecessary at our size.
You're pretty small.
Yeah. We're pretty small. I mean, 800 hex in a brewing system, really generally, you know, we're kicking out 15 kegs, you know, by the end of the day when we, you know, rack it all off. And 15 kegs is a pretty easy amount of beer to move on our taps.
Yeah.
So we don't really have to worry if we have a bit too much of something. It might go slowly every now and again. We've seen that happen where, you know, a certain style doesn't quite hit the mark with the local market. And so the beer languishes on our board for, you know, 12 weeks instead of 4 weeks. But that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, every now and again, just make sure there's a slot filled. And every beer always finds a customer. Like, that's what we found. Every beer, there's always a customer for every style. It's just sometimes only 3 or 4% of the population wants, you know, whatever, an English mild at 3.5%. Like, we just don't have a lot of people that want to drink that.
Which is too bad because they are so tasty.
Yeah.
But I'm just as guilty because I don't drink them very often.
Right.
Yeah. But when I do, it's just like, holy crap, this is good.
Exactly.
Yeah. But we're always chasing the new.
Yeah, chasing the new, or you want big flavor, or you want, you know, higher in alcohol, or...
Yeah.
You want lower?
People need to just realize that you can still have big flavor and low alcohol.
Yeah.
They definitely happen.
Yeah.
Some of the English milds I've had have been amazing. It's not as low, but like even like Stein beers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you throw in the hot rocks and the caramelization you get from that, you can just skyrocket the flavor, even though the alcohol is quite a bit lower.
Down there. Yeah. You get a nice robust kind of flavor and complex flavors. And
or look, some of the Belgians, like some of the flavors you get out of a Belgian beer that's still only like 3% alcohol.
Yeah, exactly. Some of those table beers that come out for sure.
Or like some of those like crazy lambics and stuff that are really low alcohol, mm-hmm. but really high flavor.
Yeah.
So just got to stop walking by that low alcohol beer because you're like, look at how much money that is for that. Well, maybe look at it a little longer.
Yeah. I mean, and luckily too, like you get... The idea that alcohol content equals value is kind of going away now a little bit. Maybe that's just me because I'm getting older. And
I think we're all guilty to a percentage, you know.
But. Yeah, but you know, I remember when I was, you know, teenager, 18, 19 years old, and you're like, if you had $20 to your name, then you were getting the Wildcat Strong. Like that's just this is what it was.
Yep.
But now as you sort of learn a bit more, he's like, you don't need to have the biggest, strongest beers to enjoy a glass, and getting wasted isn't the goal.
There is a reason there is that Edwards 40 hands or whatever. It's because some people are broke and want to drink too much.
Exactly.
It's not for me. Tried it once when I worked at a liquor store as a 19-year-old.
Oh, geez.
Just OE, not Edward 40 or whatever it was called.
Yeah, yeah. This is our pale ale. Yeah, so Backroads Pale Ale. So yeah, West Coast style.
That's kind of really nice. Clear, actually. Yeah.
Tropical hops flavors in there.
Yeah, lots of going on there with tropical fruits.
Yeah, 4.5%, and nice and hoppy, but not bitter. So there you go.
Yeah, it's really tropical, but it's got like the malt bill kind of builds behind that fruit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, a hint of bitterness. It's not a lot going on there for bitterness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really easy drinking, too.
Yeah, that one's... I mean, there's a reason that one stayed around as our kind of the core brand for us. It's been super popular, you know, since day one, and we definitely move a lot of that beer here in the tap room. And that one, you know, is out in the bottle in liquor stores, and it's a very, very consistent seller for us on the liquor store shelves. So.
These are definitely all, like, patio crushers here. Which is great, because if the weather would just go back to what it was last week.
Yeah. I mean, our board's a bit light right now in terms of just the overall style. Like, we've got, you know, the Northwest IPA on there right now, which I didn't give you, but you've had that before.
You were just drinking it before.
It's
really tasty. It's got that bitterness that you don't get a lot in IPAs these days.
Yeah, that dank and earthy kind of old school IPA.
Kind of miss them.
I think a few people do.
Yeah.
So that one's probably the heaviest beer on the board right now. And I mean, the black lager, you know, I don't know if you had that one or not yet, but, you know, we're sort of running a dark beer just because we need a dark beer every now and again. But even not that heavy.
Yeah,
overall, no, even though it's a black lager, it's still pretty light.
I don't know if I've had that beer actually.
It's been around. Yeah, it wasn't around when you were here the first time. So,
and I've only had a couple of beers since I was here last because I don't get it in Vancouver. So,
yeah, I know it's tough for us to send beer all the way down there.
Oh no, yeah, no. Small system, and there's enough customers here to bother, right?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I'd love to see my beer in down on the coast. You know, because I grew up down there. I have all kinds of friends that are always asking me where they can buy my beer. And I just have to tell them, sorry, guys, like, you're going to have to come visit.
Yeah. Or next time you go down to visit them, just throw it in the back of your vehicle.
Oh, yeah. I've always, every time I go down to the coast, there's always a few cases kind of with me and makes the rounds and ends up in friends and family's places for sure. Or you get the odd request when people come up to visit and they've got to bring back a whole lot.
Yeah.
Kind of get it around, but
it never hurts either when you go to Vancouver or wherever you're going, just bring some of your beer to another brewery, right?
Yeah, we do that. You know, we often trade around a little tiny bit.
I mean, I went to Atlanta and I brought a bunch of beer with me for that exact reason.
Yeah, that's great. That's
butters
the fun.
People up.
Yeah, it totally does. It totally does.
So you sell some packaged product.
Yep.
Is it just bombers? What do you do?
Yeah, right now we're just bombers. And then we'll do the odd barrel-aged beer into 750 champagne bottles.
Oh, nice.
And
actually, I've had one of those.
Yeah,
there's the one.
A beer de garde.
Yeah, that's right.
That came
out.
That was...
I almost forgot about that.
Within our first year.
I still have that bottle.
Do you really?
Yeah. I love the label because it's kind of that, like, the wood grain
label. It has a wood. That was a birch veneer. Now that was done. We had those done at Summit Printing in Vancouver.
No way.
And it's a really neat kind of actual real wood grain that's been thrown on.
I've seen it on one or two other bottles locally, but that's about it.
I think Four Winds was doing one for one of their releases.
Yeah.
A little bit of a wood grain thing, and that's kind of where we saw it. I think that's where I saw it the very first time. So I called up Summit and was like, "Hey, like, what? Tell me about this thing." And we thought it was kind of fun for wood-aged beers to have a wood label on the outside and kind of elevate the presentation of it a little tiny bit and justify the $16 price it was.
Yeah. Worth every penny, though, right?
Worth every penny. Yeah, exactly. Other than that, so our Bombers is our main package format right now. We don't have a lot of room for canning. We were looking at the idea of getting canning going. But we don't really have the space for canning, so we're trying to work out how we're going to make that all come together.
it's always a fight, right?
It's always a fight. And then, of course, you know, the cost side of it for a startup was also a thing that we had to think about. So when we started doing a little bit of bottling, we were just kind of looking at the costs of different packaging systems, and we found a two-head semi-automatic, semi-manual filler from HDP. And it was sort of affordable at $18,000, whatever, all said and done, you know, like shipped from, where's it made? Having HDPs in Halifax.
I'm not even sure.
Somewhere out east, you know, so shipped across the country. That was an affordable way versus a canning machine might be $40,000, $50,000 to get into it for a base level kind of thing that we would be happy with.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Mike, even though it's a small bottling system that we have and it's not incredibly efficient, it has a lot of kind of bells and whistles on the production side that Mike wants to help ensure that we package in a quality way.
Yeah, for sure.
And so we splurged a little bit on some of the features. But it puts out a bottle that we're happy with. And, it's labor intensive. We don't churn a lot of bottles out on a bottling day. It's kind of laughable.
Yeah.
We work really hard to get a couple pallets of beer. Like, I'm off to the Okanagan on Thursday for our delivery run, and man, it's going to be a lot of hours of labor sort of needlessly, just because we do things in such a manual fashion. But, back to the original part, it was easy financially for us to get into packaging using Bombers. And we still kind of like that size of beer. It's a shareable size, I think there's still a market for Bombers. You know, there's a lot of talk about everything switching to cans.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that the Bomber is necessarily a dead format for packaging beer, and you get a lot of push from the beer nerds and the beer media about cans these days, and a lot of breweries that sort of tell people that, hey, you should be drinking your beer in cans, but there's no reason why you also shouldn't have your beer in a bomber every now and again. Like, it's still an okay way, and
especially for like crazy one-offs and stuff.
Yeah,
it's still a really viable spot for a lot of breweries that are doing barrel aged and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, what I've noticed too sometimes is that like you'll walk into a liquor store and you'll see all these four packs, and then I'm noticing that the liquor stores are slowly starting to break up those four packs, and they're putting out single 473 cans now. Yeah. So it's just like the same thing is just happening, it's just in different format.
Well, that has been my biggest complaint with four packs is like I love the tall can.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to buy, especially with like the juicy IPAs that are like $20-$22 a four pack.
Yeah.
I don't want four of them because I want to get some more beer too.
Yeah.
It's like if you're buying a four pack of $20 beer, that's probably the one you're buying and that's it.
It's back to that brand loyalty, you know, concept, right? And so with the bomber, at least, you know, you're getting, you know, 650 mils of beer. So you're getting a proper sized serving at 21 ounces. You know, you get a full pint, which in my opinion is how much you need to know if you like a beer or not. You can't tell off a 5 ounce taster. You need a whole beer.
But flight's great to learn about
flight's
beer.
Great. You can learn about it. But, you know, with a bomber, you're getting to try a beer for $7.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, you know, $8. And that's, I think to me, that's a fair price to pay to see it, you know, to try something new. If you're interested in trying beer and versus having four cans at $22
and if they're great,
and
it's
2 liters of beer,
But if they're bad or, you know, it's not really your thing, you've just invested $20 on four beer that you don't like.
Suffering through it, or you're trading it away to your buddies at ball practice or
exactly
whatever else, trying to pawn them off on your hockey team that refuses to drink craft beer.
No, you just got to bring the cheapest shitty beer. And here you go, guys.
Yeah.
This one's mine. I guess, where do you see the brewery going in the next couple of years? Are you happy with the size you are now, or are you out of space?
Yeah, well, when we're physically out of space, absolutely. But as I said, we have some runway room on the production side. You know, we're probably running at about 60% capacity in the actual brewing part of it right now. So we've got some space to ramp up the production. So, you know, we see ourselves, you know, kind of just rounding out our distribution footprint. You know, in the next couple of years, we're not going to be a brewery that distributes across the province.
Yeah,
so you're going to see us in the Okanagan. You're going to see us in the east, kind of the southeast Kootenai for sure. Maybe getting up into Shuswap, Revelstoke region, and maybe as far as Golden. But realistically, it's going to be sort of what we can distribute to in an efficient manner. We self-distribute our beer. We sort of refuse to take salespeople and distribution partners. We want to do it all ourselves. We think that's important. So it's kind of whatever, you know, I can physically, what I can do myself right now. And then as we grow a little bit and can afford to hire another, you know, distribution person, someone to help us with packaging and delivering, driving the van, you know, and bringing beer around to the stores.
You'd never have one title in beer.
No,
it's always this plus this.
So I think, you know, for the next couple of years, that'll be us kind of pushing that out. As I said, we're looking at that can model, even though I said I love bombers. We still are looking at cans. And realistically, you're going to see our core beers show up in cans. And so then we'll see where things are at with our footprint, you know. And once we get to kind of running to 2,800, 3,000 hex a year, then we'll be having a conversation about whether or not we want to go any bigger than that. Or whether or not, you know, maybe we're only three business partners in the brewery, so maybe we're earning a living by that point that we're all happy with, and we don't need to keep adding more and more and more distribution points
on
further and further and further away. And, you know, who knows, 2 years is a long time. There's going to be an awful lot of breweries in this province at that point, and you don't know what the competitive landscape is going to be like when you're trying to sell beer outside of your home region.
You're already seeing the slowdown a bit in Vancouver, so.
Yeah, and I was just reading a story the other day about the Oregon industry and how some of the legacy breweries are now really feeling the pinch and they're starting to close. And there's that question of, is there enough tap space or shelf space and to support the whatever 350 or 400 breweries in that state.
Yeah.
Whatever
and
it is.
I think a majority of them are in Portland too.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them in that one city.
There's a lot there. And so how many are, you know, so in this province, how many are going to be able to send their beer around the province? Yeah. And so we don't know where that's going to be at. So we sort of feel like let's kind of not try to grow beyond what we're comfortable growing with. And, you know, we can always kind of reassess. If we stay small enough, we can reassess very easily and rapidly. But it's a big jump. We're, you know, when we go from this facility to, you know, say building a production facility, kind of a la what Steamworks did, you know, it's a big, big step to say, okay, now we're making.
Or locally, Torchlight.
Yeah, I mean, those guys, I mean, they moved down the road. And
yeah, but it's still a much larger facility
way,
from what
way larger,
had, so.
Way larger. And, but I think with those guys, they needed to be in a bigger space like that because their original location
was too small.
Was way too small and was not well set up for what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so now they've got a real, like a real space. Which is fantastic and a really cool location and a sort of an emerging part of town in the lower part of downtown. But yeah, for someone like us, it's a really like huge step. And I know that's when you start growing into that above 3,000, you know, 3,000 to 10,000 hectoliter range, like that's kind of the danger zone where you can just kill yourself by going way above your head. And then,
well, you're seeing a lot of breweries right now in the States that have expanded to failure.
Yeah.
So it's a real, real sticking point.
Yeah.
You got to be careful.
So we run this great little tap room. You know, we got 100 seats. We have potential within this building. So we actually have, we don't own our building yet, but there's apartments upstairs.
Nice.
On our thing. And so, you know, in the long term, you know, maybe there's potential for something to happen on our upstairs floor and we can sort of grow our own, just keep growing our own thing within our own existing building.
Yeah, that'd be awesome if you could somehow push some or all of your tasting room upstairs maybe. And
yeah, there's all kinds of different things you could do that could make things really interesting and sort of keep the focus on the tap room and not have to worry about trying to like compete for shelf space in Vancouver or Victoria or Calgary or wherever else.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that's a tough game to be in.
Yes, it is. I guess because I'm from Vancouver. A lot of the listeners are Vancouver.
Yeah.
What's the beer scene like up here in the Kootenays these days? It's been a couple of years since I've been up here. Things have changed a bit. There's some new breweries.
Things have changed a bit. A couple new breweries. So since we've opened, we had Trail Beer Refinery opened almost around the same time as us.
I was there too.
It might have been even the same weekend, or at least within a week of each other. They opened up there. Angry Hen Brewing opened up in Caslow.
I'm going there on Thursday.
Great little brewery. Yeah, they're fantastic. Good friends of ours up there. I know there's a brewery in the works in Castlegar right now, which is long overdue. Castlegar is sort of one of those towns, you know, like 10,000 people, no brewery.
Great. Especially with a great pub right across the river.
With the
Robson,
Lions. With the Lions head right across the road. You know, there's definitely the demand for locally made beer in Castlegar. I mean, they've always had, you know, quote unquote local with NBC and then, you know, Rosslyn, the boys at Rosslyn Beer Company.
They're great
you know,
too, yeah.
You know, being able to put beer out. But so that's coming together. So now, so we're going to be, you know, within an hour's drive of Nelson, there's going to be 8 breweries overall. So that's pretty good. That's pretty healthy. I mean, we're as I was saying earlier before, we were chatting beforehand, it's like there's 70,000 odd people kind of in the whole Central Kootenay region,
which is a fairly big region.
People, I mean, it's a big distance region. It's a lot of driving between them. None of us care because we're all used to this. So, you know, to drive to Castlegar to go do something is no big deal. It's only 45 minutes. Like, how many people commute from Chilliwack or Abbotsford into the city?
That's like an hour and a half.
Yeah, exactly. That blows me away.
Yeah, not
so,
quite
like, for
anymore.
Us, for us, just to go to to Castlegar, and so people can live in one and work in the other city and. And then all the rural people that live around you. I get a lot of people get surprised at how many people actually live in our region.
Yeah.
Sometimes because you're like, oh, yeah, Nelson's 10,000 and Castlegar is 8,000 or 9,000 and Trail's 8 or 9,000. So it's like, so there's 30,000. So where's the other 40 live? And it's like, well, they all live in the woods.
Yeah.
Kind of off grid on their hippie farms. but they all come into town for great beer.
Yeah.
And so there's a demand for local beer is definitely there. And so it's been a growing scene and I think it's going to be great that we're adding a couple more breweries into the area to really create a destination for tour. I think that's a big thing for us. It's like, for me, coming from a tourism background, I really see the tourism side as being a super important part of local brewing. And obviously the province is fully behind that. I mean, we've seen them really support kind of the BC Ale Trail initiative that's come together. And, we all know, the Okanagan took off like crazy with their wine destination thing. So there's no reason why the brewing side shouldn't happen as well. And so if we have, 7 or 8 breweries kicking around within this region, it makes it a lot easier to say, hey, Mike, you want to take a 4-day weekend, drive up from the city, come hang out in Nelson, go do cool stuff like camping, biking, hiking, skiing, snowboarding, whatever. And, by the way, there's a bunch of really cool breweries around here.
Last time I came up here was for Torchlight's grand opening of their new location.
Yeah. So that's, there'll be that 1 or 2% of people like you
that will,
that will travel for the brewery first. And then they're like, oh, yeah, by the way, I really like to go hiking and I'll go hiking in all these cool spots.
Oh, exactly.
But if you get trapped at the brewery, you're not going to be too panicked over it.
No. Yeah, when the weather turns bad, I guess I better go to a brewery.
Oh, man. This past weekend, we had some pretty ugly kind of downpour spells, and the tap room was so jammed with people.
That's awesome.
All day long, and it's always so funny because they're always thinking like, oh yeah, great weather, you're going to sell beer. And then it's actually like, well, when you have a tap room, rainy weather is actually really, really good for business.
It is, yeah.
The sunny weather does well. Like, we notice it. The sunny weather drives our sales in liquor stores and drives our sales in the restaurants on the patios, but when the rain comes in, the brewery just takes off like crazy. People just want to hang here. But why not? It's a good
spot. Wants to stand in the rain, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I guess as we kind of get to the end here, do you have any exciting projects kind of working on in the next month or two, couple months, year?
Not really. Because of this whole big expansion, we just sort of finished doing that. The brewing expansion room that wrapped up really in, I'd say, end of January. We were 100% complete and kind of using that room on a daily basis. So that's only, 4 months ago? 5 months ago now?
That's
so,
ages in brewery time, isn't it?
It is. So so that's sort of the end to any major things. We don't really have an appetite to do anything crazy right now. I'm just going to kind of let the business run. We are, as I said, we put out a new beer every single month, packaging-wise. So we've got a few kind of plans in the works for doing some more beers. That way, we're doing a collab project with White Tooth Brewing.
Nice.
Coming up. And we just did one a month and a half ago. Released a Maibock with them.
Oh, nice.
Which is really good. We just ran out of it on the bar here the other day. They still have some up there, I think. And the Lionshead Pub actually might still have a keg of our beer, or of the Maibock. I don't know if they've tapped it yet.
I don't think they did, because I think probably I had wasn't. Your Juicy IP.
Yeah, so they might not have tapped the Maibock yet. So we're going to do another collab brew with White Tooth. That one will come out in November. So nice. Kind of a winter themed, skiing themed beer.
Where are they again?
They're in Golden.
Golden, okay.
And they're really, really good friends of ours. So that's kind of a fun thing to do a collab with them. Kind of, it's a long way away. I always laugh when you see all these breweries in Vancouver and they, do collabs along the Fraser River or something like that. And it's like, oh yeah, we get to, work with our guys just down the road. And we're like, oh man, we get to drive 700 kilometers to go and brew with somebody else for one day and then come all the way back. And
well, you could just drive down the road, but
yeah, funny enough, we haven't done a collab with any of the other breweries around in town, but I think that might happen, as we sort of all grow together and kind of become better, better friends with all the other breweries. Then you start to see that working together. We've talked with Angry Hen a little bit about doing a collab, but it hasn't come together yet. But it's a bit of a different industry up here. It doesn't have the same kind of Uber. I shouldn't say it's not Uber friendly. We're super friendly with everyone. We just haven't all gotten to the point where we're ready to all work together all the time yet.
Yeah.
But we definitely, there's a lot of appetite to work with the next town over to do a collab project. So working on that. And then, as I said, we're sort of working towards some can, getting some products into can. So that might take us, another kind of year or 8 months to kind of work out the logistics of putting that together and making sure we've got the right kind of facilities in place. And the hard thing for us is storage. We have no storage space. And so we've got to sort of solve that problem before we can start worrying about having pallets and pallets of cans showing up.
Is there any options for mobile canning out this far? Or?
Yeah, there's, Mile 37 has been coming up here in the past. I know Torchlight was using them before they got their own canning machine. And West Coast Cans will come out here. We haven't brought them. Originally, we asked them about it, and the minimum canning amount was beyond what we actually had in cellar capacity.
Yeah, that makes it hard, doesn't it?
So we're like, okay, well, this isn't going to work, but maybe now we have the capacity for that. So, but we don't even have a place like, so when those mobile canners show up, they usually roll the canner off the truck and bring it into your facility. We don't have room for the canner to show up in the facility, nor do we have like access through a loading door. Like, we don't have a garage loading door in the back. We have a half flight of stairs to a regular size door. So, like, we'd have to be canning on the street out front, which would be hilarious. It'd be great. People would love to see that. But there's some other things. Some
could
other.
You fit it through the front door there, and
you could. Yeah, you could get for the front
close
door.
Close on a Monday or something.
And there's a couple other ideas. We've got a couple of other sticks and other fires that we're talking with some other groups that we can make this work. So nice. It's just a matter of getting the logistical side of things all put together. So we can start putting some beer in cans to appease all the can folks.
Exactly. Was there anything we missed talking about here that you'd like to tell the people about?
Just come out and visit. Like, especially for all you Vancouver kind of island folks, like, take a road trip out here.
Yeah.
Come see it. Like, it's such a cool part of the world to come and visit, and you know, I think it's something different, you know, like, you don't always have to go to Whistler or Kelowna for your vacations.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
I know it's a bit more of a drive to come out here. You got to plan a little bit for it, but honestly, it's worthwhile. There's so much good stuff. And if you're a beer nerd and you want to come for specifically because you want to come and try beer, there's tons and tons of beer options that are out here. But if you're more of a camping, hiking, fishing, skiing, snowboarding person, like, you really need to come out here because it's phenomenal. And you know, by the way, there's awesome towns and awesome breweries in those towns, and, you know, experiences that you're not going to get in Vancouver, Whistler, or Victoria. So,
and I have to say that this must be one of the only towns that has a campground in the middle of town.
We do have a campground.
I mean, you know, usually you go to a city or town and you have to get the $100+ hotel room.
Yeah.
You can get a $30-something campground here.
You can. Yeah. I've never camped there.
I have.
But
my second time right now.
Yeah, I know it books up really fast. I know it's
actually room right now. It's pretty surprising.
Is it really?
Yeah.
It's a bit early in the year yet. We'll see. By the middle of summer, it'll go crazy.
Yeah.
Especially when the Shambhala crowd starts to show up.
Bet,
and they hang out for 2 weeks waiting for the festival out there. And then they hang out for another 2 weeks afterwards when they're detoxing.
Exactly. But, I mean, that right alone, like, you can come to Nelson and stay pretty cheap.
Yep.
You can save money on your lodging as long as you get a tent, maybe a tarp right now.
Yeah, exactly. There's plenty of options. And there's even, you know, camping further, you know, if you want to go up the lake somewhere. And
real camping, too. Yeah.
Like, get some real camping in if you don't want to just sleep in your tent in the middle of the city, which is...
Makes it easy to stumble to breweries.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's lots of great stuff to do, and it's worth the 8-hour drive, kind of up from the coast.
It sure is, yeah.
It's a fantastic place to be. So,
I just made the drive a couple days ago.
You did, yeah.
All right, where can people find you guys online, and then what's your address too?
So online, we're at backroadsbrewing.com or on Instagram at backroadsbrewing. Our physical address is 460 Baker Street, right in the heart of beautiful Nelson, BC.
Awesome. Before we close out here, I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters. So if you want to support us on Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/Pacific Beer Chat. So shout out to Indie Beer Show, Liz from Hop Bower, and Steve. Cheers. Thanks for tuning in to Pacific Beer Chat. We can be found on all podcast apps as well as at pacificbeerchat.com. If you find a podcast app we are missing on, let us know and we'll endeavor to fix that. Leave us a review on iTunes as it helps expose more people to the show. You can email us at feedback@pacificbeerchat.com. We can be found on all major social media apps at Pacific Beer Chat. Logo design was by Tim, the craft beer tourist. Audio editing done by Cam, known as Cam on Tap on Twitter. To play us out, here is a clip of the song Lothian by the band Conundrum, performed by Kevin Ems.
Find them at conundrum-music.bandcamp.com. The song that plays us out is part of our intro.